Well, hello there, faithful listener. It's yourself. Come away in and I'll get the kettle on. I'm Darren and this is the Small Voice podcast for the month of May. As ever, I'm joined by the regular team of Margaret.
Hello.
And Anne.
Hello.
And we'll be bringing you our usual mix of news, chat and music for the next hour or so. You know the drill by now, media review, 1,000 words, Small Voice, bookshelf and the moral mixdown. They're all here waiting for you, as well as live music. And this month, we're delighted that Steve Butler has joined us in the studio to sing us a couple of his songs. Not only will Steve be singing, but he's going to sit in for the whole show. Well, he says he is. I'd better check the contract. So, quick health check on the team. Has your month been heavenly or a bit hellish? Margaret, what do you reckon?
Oh, definitely heavenly. A month that includes Easter and a weekend's holiday and a couple of days off work and a few walks and a bit of sunshine even. Yeah, definitely heaven.
A clear and confident answer.
Absolutely.
Anne.
Well, as usual for me, it's something a bit more ambivalent. I suppose in a month that contains both Holy Week and Easter, it's a bit of hell and a bit of heaven. Because in our church, we try to take it a day at a time and not pretend we know the outcome or we know the answer. So if you really let yourself feel it and experience it, you go through those moments of hell before on Easter morning, it's heaven.
Okay. And Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And how's your month been?
Well, I'm with Anne. Being a ritualistic sort of Anglican person, we really go for it. So it was very good, but a bit grueling by the end.
Was it a kind of early Sunday morning thing? Well, on the beach at four?
You name it. We okay. Did it.
I feel I'm letting the team down here because I was away on holiday and actually on Easter Sunday I was... Well, Easter Sunday I was travelling by car from the southern states of the US up through in pursuit of Newark. And then the hell I can confidently say that is Newark self-service check-in. Big name check for United Airlines here, folks, I tell you. But I can hardly claim that was really painful compared to your very deep and... Well, I think yours had a better ending than mine did, except,
but
I suppose...
Did you feel that you'd miss something by travelling
on
Easter?
Yes, I do. And people have said that to us before. You know, you really... You know, you should be around the church at that time. Not that they're waving hands and giving us a row, but if you're a teacher and these are the holidays you have to take and you're trying to get over, in particular, to a place like Georgia, which is in the States, which is incredibly hot in the summer, you tend to go at Easter time. So, yeah, but I think next year we'll definitely stay put so we can experience the full misery of Easter before then rejoicing in the resurrection. Okay, on with the show. A quick bit of news first, and I hope you don't mind us bigging up our wee podcast, because what do you know, we've been nominated for an award. To be specific, our Christmas Small Voice show has been nominated in the podcast category for the Sanford St Martin's 2014 Awards. Go Team Small Voice. So thanks as ever to everyone who's been in touch with us this month, especially to those of you sending us congratulations and best wishes for the awards bash. We're Scottish, so of course we'll be journeying down to London on the 3rd of June in the sure and certain expectation that we will lose. Still, it'll be nice to mingle with the stars. I wonder if maybe Alan Jones might be there. Mm. And I hear that Lambeth Palace serves awfully nice canapes. Anne, have you been?
I have, yes. I've previously won something there.
I'm thinking sun-dried tomatoes.
I don't remember
quality
the food,
purvey.
But I think the warm Lambrusco was second to none.
Okay, well, listen, you can't beat fig and goat's cheese wrapped in Parma ham, as my granny always used to say. And so finally, we've come to the month of May. Before you know it, we'll be casting clutes and enjoying balmy Scottish weather of 12 degrees Celsius. Now, May also sees the return of Christian Aid Week, so we thought we'd give you a wee recipe from Delia for giving of your very best this year.
Now, last week I showed you how to plug in the kettle. This week I want to show you how to do something equally tricky, how to give money to charity. Now, you may have seen one of these. It's called a collection tin. This one's 7 centimetres in diameter. Now, what I'm going to do next is get some money out of my purse. You can use a spoon, but I'm going to go in with my hands. On the top of the collection tin, you notice a slot. That's where your money goes, like so. Straightforward, isn't it? Yet around 35% of us never give money to charity. Now, that does tend to leave a bad taste in the mouth.
OK, time for our media review, and boy, have we got a belter for you this month. Over to you, Margaret.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. Well, we have given ourselves a proper challenge, I think, after we had a wee sitcom last time, Rev. Perhaps a bit more than we thought it was going to be. And then we had lots of fun with the Lego movie the month before. So what about a bit of Norwegian? In fact, we've gone for Carl Ove Knausgård. I think we've all been practising the yes. pronunciation. Now, his first novel was the first debut novel to win the Norwegian Critics Prize. His second was widely acclaimed. And the one that we've been reading, which is entitled A Death in the Family, has already won the Braga Award and is being heralded as a masterpiece. Not my words, I just picked them up off the book, the little biography details. But I wonder whether, is it a masterpiece? We have been reading it in English, not in Norwegian, I hasten to add. But this one is the first of a trilogy entitled My Struggle. So is it a struggle or a masterpiece? First question, of course, when we have a long book to read is, did we actually make it to the end? Because I think the last one we did, I don't know if any of us got to the end of it. I have. I managed it this morning on the train. Anne, what about you?
I confess I haven't got to the end of this one.
But you were way ahead.
I was way ahead, but I got sidetracked by a new Danny Wallace novel that came out last week and got so engrossed in it that I didn't get to the end of Carl Ove's opus. It's not a difficult read, so that wasn't the reason. But it's, again, like one of the previous books that we reviewed, kind of circular rather than linear in its development. And sometimes you do have to go back a bit to catch up with yourself. So that's my reason for not getting to the end. But it is a strikingly, brutally honest autobiography. And I think that's the thing which probably provoked the kind of controversy that this series of books has seen in Norway, because he spares you absolutely nothing. Don't know what you thought, Darren.
Well, first up, I'll fess up and say this is all my fault. You know, I like looking at the books of the year list and stuff, and this book was getting praised to the highest heaven. And when I saw that Nigella Lawson was tweeting that she was enjoying it, I thought, I need an excuse to be forced to read this book. I then picked up a cheap copy in a charity shop. Refreshingly unread, I have
I was
to say
that might have told you something.
Charity shop unread, yes.
And I thought, what will make me read this? I know we should review it, but I'm not an English teacher from a former life. I found it really hard to read. I've got some basic rules. If a page is a paragraph, if I can't see a little indentation, you know, where, because you know, I like to feel that you've read a bit of a paragraph, then it's heavy going, and I found it very slow. It does pick up. There are certain things that happen. I mean, you're not giving anything away by saying that his father is a key figure in the book. And I think that's what's caused the controversy, is that his father's side of the family have kind of disowned Carl Ove over this. He does spare you nothing. He doesn't come out of it as very pleasant. And I think maybe that's what people like, the kind of brutal honesty of it. I should say, by the way, Margaret, it's actually going to be six books. With the last one, and My Struggle, of course, in German, Mein Kampf. Apparently the sixth book is all about his thoughts on Adolf Hitler. It's a bit strange. So I liked it in places when things actually happened, like when his father dies and his father has been living in squalor as an alcoholic, and they have to go and clear the place out. And I found that interesting, but he's not a sympathetic character. And I just sometimes wonder if I'm completely missing what the big point of this book is.
I think that is the point. I mean, we all self-edit, we all present ourselves in a certain way to the world, and he decided as a kind of thesis that he was going to write about truth, or whatever that truth about himself and about his family actually was. And so there's, you know, the point where, you know, you really have least sympathy for him, I think, is when he's talking about his children at one point, and he talks about not liking his kids, not liking his children, not feeling any sort of sense of love for his children, which may have been true in that moment and is maybe true of countless parents at certain points in their lives when children are small and difficult to handle and you can't get any work done and whatever else. Most parents don't tell you that. They edit themselves when they present themselves to the world. But he risks telling you, I don't feel anything for my kids at that point. And it's the same when he talks about members of his family. So it's not that he treats them any worse than he treats himself. But it raised a lot of questions for me about what right you have to say anything about other people. If you're writing something which is ostensibly the truth, really, do you have the right to let the whole world know certain intimate things about other members of your family? And I mean, it did make me think, because all, you know, all three of us, Darren, Margaret and I, have all written and spoken material which has included quite intimate details about our family. You know, but when I wrote about my mother's death, I didn't consult my sister before that was broadcast. When you wrote about your dad dying, I doubt if you asked your brother, Darren.
Yeah, that's true.
Or did you? I mean,
no, I mean, so, I've speculated. I think I'd like to think my brother liked what I wrote, but he might have felt that was too personal.
He might have done. And I mean, and I sort of trusted in my terms that, you know, my sister would like it too, but I didn't ask her in advance. And I think this book made me think a lot about the way that we all mine our own lives as material, whether, I guess, as Steve, as songwriters, I mean, I guess you write out of your experience and your personal relationships.
Sure, and a lot of the time it's like family narratives, and that may come up.
And if you do, have you sometimes sung a song and then, you know, your wife has said, oh, so you're singing about that then? Or has it never been quite as blatant as that?
Well, there's a fantastic Get Out as a songwriter. You just say, well, it's just a song, you know. It's just, it's not real.
I suppose that there's an element where you do have to be careful. I remember deciding that when I was writing material for radio, which was going out on local radio in the morning, that I would not talk about my children because their teachers were listening.
Yeah.
And the last thing that my daughter wanted was teacher making comments about what mother had said in the morning.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, I can't do this. It's not it's not fair. I can reassure you guys, I think I enjoyed the ending perhaps better than a whole lot that had gone before. There were parts reading this book where I thought, if I didn't have to do this, I'd have flung it away.
Are you going to be back for the next five volumes?
Well, actually, towards the end, I did begin to think, well, I wonder how it's going to follow. And I actually went back to the beginning. Very often, you find you get to the end of a book and actually you have to go back to the beginning to find out what's in it. And I was quite intrigued that the connection between the end and right back at the beginning does seem to make sense. But I did find it quite a struggle, I think, going through it.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, listen, the book is published by Vintage, and volume 3 has only just come out now, and it's in hardback. So that's a sign of confidence from the publisher. To give one quote from the book, I just thought I would read this little piece, which is only a couple of lines, but he's talking about how he's unsuccessful with women. And he says, I have never been in any doubt that this is what girls I've tried my luck with have seen in my eyes, too much desire and too little hope. And if I had to give a quick one-sentence review of the book, I rather fear it would be too much desire and too little hope. But maybe that's just me. Now, one other really, really quick thing is to follow on from last month's discussion about Rev. We can't do any spoilers, but is it safe to say that we would all advise people to head on over to iPlayer if they haven't yet done so and watch the rest of it?
Without a doubt.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, there's not much more we can say, really. I think you just have to.
We really would be giving too much away.
To say that most of the reviews have missed the point completely. You know, almost every review that we've read of the series has completely missed the point. So it is worth seeing it for yourself and making up your own mind what you think about it. But I think it's safe to say
we think
it was splendid.
Indeed. Now, that's more than enough media review for this month. If you have any views on what we've discussed or you want to suggest something for us to review in a later podcast, then why not drop us a line via our website smallvoice.org.uk or tweet us at @small_voice1. Okay, now Steve is going to be singing for us, Steve Butler. I was going to say, one time of Lies, Damned Lies, or are Lies, Damned Lies still going? Or
well, you know.
Never say never.
You never know.
And also you've had some solo albums. I was going to ask, we record the show at GRF Studios in Glasgow, and I do recall us making a programme where we played in a track from Lies, Damned Lies from the record, the big record contract. Was that a... Because remember, we've had a few singing revs on the programme recently, but you got the big big contract. Well, I don't know if it was big, but you certainly got your record deal.
It was quite big.
Yeah. Was that a frustrating experience?
In hindsight. not really. In the long view of things, it was great. We had a great 3 years spending Richard Branson's money.
Oh, splendid.
So there's nothing to be moaned about with that.
Oh, well, that was a put you
good
in a
good old
mood.
Rich. I always said he was a good guy.
And if you're listening, Richard, good on you. But then, of course, you've got your own record label.
Yeah, I mean, you're going back a bit now.
I'm sorry.
After that, we evolved a whole kind of thing of our own with a studio and a record label and a publishing company. And that was a really heady few years. This is going back 20 years now.
I'm showing my age.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
I thought it was about 10. Well, I would have said 10 years ago. There you go. Just shows me. But you have had a couple of solo albums that we certainly have on heavy rotation in our car. I can assure you that. So you're going to sing us a song. What's your first one?
Okay, well, this is a time of life family narrative, I suppose. It's the time of life when your children are leaving home. And you have a sort of fantasy that you're going to, like a movie, you're going to sit down and give them some really good advice, but you don't.
Okay, so this is this the advice in
this
the song?
Is it, yeah.
Okay, right. Well, let's hear it. So, Steve's going to be singing the song "Clear," which I know you, I've certainly got on the CD "Clear." So here we go.
The windows of St. Christopher's aren't stained glass anymore. They took them out and filled them up. Put bars upon the doors. The lights are on, but there's no one at home. The wheels that you would die for keep rolling down that road. There are limitations on your time. The salvation of each moment's on the line. The lights are on. You will find you will only feel what we've all agreed upon. But what's consensual and real about the prize has to be won. Clear to the lurk, and the onion tastes so sweet. I would not trust myself to know the choices that would let you grow. I sit by my convictions. Nothing would surprise me anymore. The lights are on. You will find you will only feel
what we've all agreed upon. But what's consensual and real about the prizes to be won? A clear to the left, a clear to the right, a clear just about anywhere that isn't out of sight. A clear to the left, a clear to the right, a clear just about anywhere that isn't out of sight. The lights are on, but there's no one at home. The lights are on, but there's no
Thank you so much, Steve. Now, back you come, and we'll just have a quick chat about that. Now, that's on, I was going to say that's on the CD Clear, but I'm feeling maybe I've got a valuable thing in my possession. Can people still get these CDs?
No, not really. Although I'll give you a world exclusive piece of news.
Please
which
do.
Is that I'm finishing, I never thought it was finished, that album. So I'm finishing it 10 years later.
So,
and it's going to, we're redoing bits of it, and there's bits where there's solos that aren't there. So we're going to do
it's
that.
Kind of, it's kind of the remastered version.
And it's going to be called Clearer. So one of these days soon.
Oh, excellent. Listen, that is really good news. Now, Steve will be singing for us again later in the programme. I'd say that we like to get our money's worth out of our guests here at Small Voice, but who said anything about money? Okay, and time for 1,000 words.
Yep, my guest this week is David Sinclair, who is our Church of Scotland minister in Glasgow. And I know, I seem to be going through an awful lot of Church of Scotland ministers in this series, but the truth is, they are an interesting bunch of people. And David is no exception. And he began by describing the photo that he'd brought along to talk about.
This is a photograph of two rows of tall concrete blocks. They're all very smooth and shiny and uniform in size and shape, and even the paving that runs between them and the little square paving blocks are all very neatly arranged in straight lines and squared off with the big blocks. And just at the far end of the picture, there's a hint of sunshine and some trees, but that's quite a long way away. And between us and there are innumerable concrete blocks, because by the end they all merge into one another.
It's quite difficult to tell what the scale is in the photograph. How tall are these concrete blocks?
Well, I'm 6 foot tall and a bit, and I'm standing up taking the picture, and you can see from the nearest of the blocks that they're at least twice my height, perhaps a good bit more than that. But actually the truth is that they're not all the same height, and the heights change, they go up and down, and the ground on which you're walking goes up and down.
Now, this is unlike anything I've ever seen before, so you need to tell me, where is this and what is this?
This is the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, and this is only a very small part of it. The line we're looking down is just one line of many, and it takes up a complete city block. One of the interesting things about it is that the ground goes down in the middle and comes up towards the street, and the blocks get higher as the ground goes down. They get bigger, so that you're getting deeper and deeper into it.
I have a tendency towards claustrophobia, and even looking down that row of blocks, I feel a slight quickening of my heart rate and just a minor panic. What does it feel like to be in amongst it?
Well, I'm pretty sure the claustrophobia is deliberate. As you go in, there is a sense of disorientation because they're all the same. You know, if you walk in a straight line, you will come out the other end. But the tendency is to turn right and turn left, and it's very easy to lose the sense of which way you're going. In the middle, they get so tall that the sky does begin to disappear. And so the experience is one of losing a sense of direction and a sense of where you're going. And when we remember the history of the Holocaust, that I'm sure is what we're meant to feel once we're into it. And perhaps the subtle thing, there are many subtle things, but one of the subtle things is that the blocks at the street are very, very low, and at the pavement, they're just level with the pavement. So you're already walking in it before you realise you are.
That sense of being on the edge of something terrible and not knowing that you're already in it is quite a disturbing thought for us today, as much as a memorial of then.
Yeah. It tells a story, at least to me it tells a story of the Holocaust, of how people gradually get into something before they know what's happening, and then they don't know how to get out. But when I look at these blocks, I use the word monolith, and it is this kind of idea of monolithic state, where everything's the same, everything's ordered and orderly, the lines are straight, and it feels like you should be knowing exactly where you are, but in fact, you don't. Because everything is orderly and uniform, you lose the landmarks and you lose a sense of purpose or direction or even responsibility. I read the book Stasiland about what happened after the war in the eastern part of Germany, and the author of that book talked about the desire of Prussia, which this area once was, for order. And that was why they bought into both the Nazis and the communist regime that followed them, because they both set out to provide order and a sense that people knew where they stood, and an idea of uniformity, that everyone was the same. And if you weren't the same, you were got rid of. But in fact, that idea of uniformity, that idea of order even, is one that very quickly, easily, and almost universally becomes one of oppression. And I think the message of this is that it was oppression for everybody, and not only for the obvious victims of the Holocaust, that everyone lost their sense of direction and their sense of purpose, and I suppose their sense of morality as well.
And yet, human beings seem to crave order, yeah. Or at least certainty.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, is that original sin? maybe the idea that we want everything ordered and orderly and everything done decently and in order. So a favourite phrase of the Church of Scotland. That kind of wanting everything predictable is a real problem if what you need is creativity, or if what you need is imagination, because you lose all that if you give in to everything being ordered and predictable and everything the same tomorrow as it was yesterday. And I suspect the Church of Scotland is not the only church that suffers from that kind of sense that we want to know where we stand, and we don't like things to be terribly new. Anything radical or revolutionary is something that has us shaking in our pews. You know.
So is this your pitch for chaos?
In Genesis, creation is out of chaos, not out of nothing, actually. And there is a sense in which if anything is to be created, there has to be some kind of turmoil, some kind of movement, some kind of stirring things up.
Some people would call that the Holy Spirit.
Some people might, and they might be right.
Okay, Anne, if you want to see the photograph of the Holocaust Memorial?
Yep, just visit our website, www.smallvoice.org.uk. And if you're interested in the book that David mentioned, Stasiland, Stories from Behind the Berlin Wall by Anna Funder, it's published by Granta and still available.
Now, on to potentially lighter matters, or maybe just a good old bun fight. We're going into shelf life, and this is the chance for a team member round the table to pitch their favourite book or novel or something that they think should be on our Small Voice bookshelf as a great example of deep Christian thought or just something that's worth having. Margaret, it's your turn.
Thank you, Darren. Yes, now, we all picked books the last time, and I think we kind of decided that we would have to try and get away from books. So my contender for the shelf this time is not a book or a film or even a TV programme, but something even more complicated. It's a radio dramatisation of a book, and in fact just a small part of it. It was intended for children, a version of The Magician's Nephew, written by C.S. Lewis. Now, this was recorded in 1988. The original book goes back to the 1950s, but the recording is from 1988. BBC production, and it has a sequence which has helped me to understand creation. Forget the Big Bangs, intelligent designs, all the science. Just listen to the song that brings Narnia into being.
And as its beam shot across the land, we saw for the first time what sort of place we were in. A valley through which a broad, swift river wound its way, flowing eastward towards the sun. But it was a valley of earth, rock and water. There was not a tree, not a bush, not a blade of grass to be seen. The earth was of many colours, fresh, hot and vivid. They made me feel excited until I saw the singer himself. And then I forgot everything else.
Bless me.
It's a lion. A lion.
Huge, shaggy and bright, the lion stood facing the risen sun, its mouth wide open in song.
Terrible world. We must fly at once. Prepare the magic.
I quite agree with you, madam. A most disagreeable place.
Hold your noise, everyone. I want to listen to the music.
Oh, just wonderful. I think what I like best about it is it's the radio programme or the sequence that I would love to have made myself. Having produced various bits and pieces before, I think, well, that just brings everything together. But the idea of the song that calls up all sorts of things into being, and there's much more of it where it describes, it starts off in darkness, they don't know where they are, and then light begins to appear and they can see it. So that's what I want to put in the shelf, just maybe even just that little bit of it, where the song calls all these things into existence.
So we're pitching for the CD.
I suppose it is, yes. It was a cassette, of course, that I had and played in the car to keep my kids amused. But there we go. But it does come together beautifully.
Yeah, the metaphor of the song really works, doesn't it? The idea of God singing the whole of the universe into being is a wonderful one. And it sort of takes you beyond any kind of rational understanding. You don't need to understand that rationally. You understand it on a wholly different level, and it works. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose it's art as opposed to science.
But then Genesis is art anyway, isn't it? Genesis is poetry, isn't it?
Yes. And you go back.
Better not be a science textbook. I'll tell you that. We're in big trouble if it is.
Oh no. But Genesis describes God speaking, and I suppose it just. C.S. Lewis takes it a step further.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, the fact that it's a lion, well, you know.
Now, you see, we've had three rounds of this just to fill Stephen in this, because we'll allow you to pitch and say what you think. And we're all been good and proper, and we've all agreed, everyone, oh, jolly good. Yeah, Tony Campoli, he gets to go on the shelf, and so does, who were the others? I can't remember.
Oh, we had Adrian Plass.
We had Adrian Plass, of course. He's sitting on the bookshelf, and also, and you had anyway. Listen, I'm possibly going to disagree here, because I get why you love the idea of God singing it into creation, but I think that, see, when novelists write something that includes a song, clearly this, to my mind, this has to be the best song ever. Now, it sounded a bit like a person yodeling, and I mean, it just, it didn't really, you know, and I'm not sure you can do that. It's like, you know, Lord of the Rings, fantastic book, fantastic films, and then you get these dreadful little songs. Is that just me, Steve? What do you think?
I did notice the howling in the background.
It was a lion. I
wondered if that was the voice of God.
see, that's kind of where I'm coming from here, Margaret. I think if it's the novel, then I go with that. And maybe even the dramatisation, but I don't know.
Yes, I suppose it's so long ago since I actually read the novel that I can't remember whether it had that same effect. And sometimes listening to something puts it into a different context. I'm very glad it wasn't. I wasn't actually watching it as well, because that would destroy it altogether. I think
they haven't made that, have they? They haven't made The Magician's Nephew as a film. They started with Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which of course was written first, and then I think he went back and wrote the prologue, which is The Magician's Nephew. But they haven't made that, and I wonder if they actually, I don't know if they're still making them now. I just think that, as we always like to say, that the pictures are so much better on radio. But I actually wonder if the songs are maybe so much better in your head. I mean, Ian Banks has got a novel. Is it Espadere Street? Where he's put in, I think, quite a few songs he wrote, you know, as his little kind of teenage band. And the band's called Rolled Gold. And there's clearly all these lyrics which he must have written himself. And I have to be honest, the lyrics aren't that great. And you at least give him the benefit of the doubt when it comes to the music. I'm not convinced. I can see that it's hugely personal to you. Was it not linked to this particular car journey or something where you first heard it and the family were all enjoying it?
I don't really think so. No. I think it was. It was just we do agonise over the creation stories and trying to make sense of it all. And I think it was hearing that, and I thought, yeah,
it's a lion yodeling.
Well, Margaret, I'm going to come to your defence, because I really don't like fantasy fiction. This is not my area. You know, put me in a room with Lord of the Rings and I would just commit suicide at the start. I really did see what you meant with this. That image has really done something for my understanding of creation. So I'm going to pitch
with
you,
Margaret. That's the image from the novel, not from the radio dramatisation.
But this is a dramatisation for kids, and I think it works on quite a simple level.
Kids going to say, "What was the lion got a thorn in his paw?" I'm being a bit cruel, but it would, that's my point. It would have to be the best song ever, and I'm not sure you can do that.
Yeah,
it must be great fun to be given the commission. You know, here you go, Steve. Can you do this song?
I was going to say the royalties will be pretty stiff. The voice of God.
And also the poor, I mean, because, you know, it's not like you're getting Bono in to sing it for you. That's, mind you, Bono, then it really would sound like a lion in pain, I guess. Now, we've never really got to the nitty gritty of the voting process before, because we haven't had the split.
I think it's got to be a...
Well, but with Steve on board as well, I think, as we say, there are three votes here.
Dear,
and if it's 2-1, then...
Listen, if we're talking about the voice of God singing, if you do ever watch the series of Rev that's just finished, I would say that line sounded better than Liam Neeson singing Lord of the Dance. So I am going to vote with Margaret for this to go onto our bookshelf.
This is really cruel. I'm going to say no for the reasons I have outlined, and I'm going to give Steve the casting, which is a dreadful thing to do.
Oh no! What a shame!
What is it they do in The Voice?
That's right. We should turn our chairs around at this point.
That is right. No, what do you reckon?
I think it's that you can't assail somebody's treasured memory of being touched by music.
Yeah. Fair point.
Oh, there you go.
But a bit of contention at last. But the vote has been cast, and so the CD or the cassette of Magician's Nephew.
Well, I couldn't find the cassette, so I had to buy a CD.
I think our technical team are pleased that you couldn't, to be honest. Anyway, that is going to be taking its place up on the shelf. OK, Okay, time for another song from Steve. So, Steve, what's the second song going to be?
A song called Barriers, a song about forgiveness, which I guess is behind so much of what matters in the world, personal and political and everything. So,
excellent. Okay, well, let's hear Barriers as Steve gets to his piano.
Today I saw you from a distance, from way up high. I picked you out from the crowd in the corner of my eye. But you don't look my way anymore. Smile at your friends and then go running out that door. I'm left wondering, which one of us are you running from? There was a sadness in your eyes, I've seen it before. Like the stare of a lover on a troubled shore. I guess we need some resolution of this unintended collusion. It doesn't suit you, my friend. The desert of silence is not an end. And I believe nothing comes to those who wear their sorrows well. It's how you lose yourself. In the pale shadow of your smile, I see traces of the you I once found. It's time to take those barriers down. Everything that I have wanted, everything that I have been. But you were my companion when it mattered. I can't say how much that means. I'm not denying what's been broken, but the voice of reason is soft spoken. Are you listening, my friend? The silence has come to an end. And I believe nothing comes to those who wear their sorrows well. It's how you lose yourself. Traces of the you I once found. It's time to take those barriers down. And I believe nothing comes to those who wear their sorrows well. It's how you lose yourself. See traces of the you I once found. It's time to take those barriers down. It's time to take those barriers down.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you. Really, really lovely songs, I have to say. Now, I've given you a chance to try and kind of p- pitch in with the CDs and where people can get them. But just shifting slightly, you're involved in the Solas Festival. So can you tell us a bit about that? Because that's coming up quite soon, isn't it?
It's coming up on the 20th of June in Perth, near Perth. Well, it's a kind of boutique-y sort of festival.
That's a good description.
We're at about 1,000 now, and we're trying to do an arts festival. That's predominantly an arts festival. That's the guiding hand on the tiller. And it's coming from, if you like, the direction of people from the Christian community of all kinds. But our ambition is to create a festival space that is somehow does away or tries to do away with the division between sacred and secular. Mm-hmm. And to create a new space where it's, you know, you're very welcome to talk about religion and politics if you want to. Uh-huh. But where we're also challenged in all sorts of ways and inspired in all sorts of ways by what performing artists are doing, what people who write on a range of cultural and political subjects are doing, and obviously the big national debate and so on. But not a sacred space or not a secular space, but a space where we do away with that dualism.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you've got, is James Robertson, the novelist?
That's right.
Yeah.
Liz Lockhead's going to be there again. I never remember.
don't worry, I have got a note here off the website. So I don't know if there's a Twitter feed for our more switched on. Oh,
there
do you know
indeed.
It?
No.
Okay. I'm sure if people go onto
That's
Twitter
always,
and have a look, they'll find it.
Solas Festival got a new website, actually.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, here's what I think. So I hope I'm right. You can find details about Solas at their website, solasfestival.co.uk. Does that sound right?
That's right.
Okay. So, we're certainly planning on getting along to it, so we hope to see you all there. Okay, the moral mixdown to close the show. It's bizarre, you know, I leave the country, as I say, I'm sure it wasn't personal, and I come back, or I'm just about to come back, and I hear that everything's kicked off because David Cameron has made a speech or has done an article somewhere about his faith and about his Christianity, which I think previously he used to describe in fairly woolly terms. I think he once had a lovely comment. He said it was a bit like a poor radio reception, it seemed to come and go. Anyway, Call Me Dave has spoken about the importance of Christianity and in the UK, and other people have weighed in and said, I think Rowan Williams said it's a post-Christian country, and Alistair Campbell has come along and said, well, you know, I always told Tony Blair that we shouldn't do religion, and meanwhile Tony Blair's talking about the potential dangers of radical Islamism. So here's our quick discussion starter. Should politicians do God? So, Margaret.
I suppose it depends where they are on the God spectrum, as it were. I was quite intrigued because I never really associated David Cameron with any much Christian faith. And to hear the way he seemed to be going, I thought, oh, is this a sign of a change? Because I'm always looking for signs of change. And, you know, are we kind of getting a wee bit further with somebody here?
The green shoots of recovery.
The green shoots, yeah, something like that, yes. And I don't know, when you come to politicians, you feel there's always an eye on what the party lets them say or what they know will strike the right chords, as it were. And there are various different ways of looking at it. I think it is always... If you are a believer, then there's going to be a way in which it affects all of your life. And if you're an honest believer, then you can't escape from it.
Oh, OK. Anne?
I guess I think if you do God personally and you happen to be a politician, it's quite good to say so up front, because everybody in public life, particularly politicians, are going to make decisions based on a set of criteria that are shaped by their beliefs and their experiences. And it's better to know what they are so that you can read what they're up to. you know, because everybody has this kind of background, either of faith or of agnosticism or atheism. And at least if it's declared, those of us who are voting for politicians or having to live in the world that they create for us, at least know what's shaping them. And it allows us to critique what they do in certain ways. So in that sense, I'm quite glad. On the other hand, we live in a multi-faith society. And we need to be clear that what politicians, if they are Christians, are doing is trying to create a safe place for people of all faiths and none. And in that sense, I guess, we are living in a secular state. And therefore, it's important that everyone, whether they're Muslim or Hindu or atheist, knows that this politician, whatever their private beliefs and understandings, is there to represent them and to make this a safe place for them.
Okay. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, picking up on what Margaret said, I mean, the problem with political leaders, particularly party leaders, saying anything like this is that you know they're not just saying it because they woke up and thought, oh, I think I'll proclaim my faith today. So you have to ask the question, who's this aimed at? You know, and he's been in trouble with conservatives in the shires and all that. And I can't help feeling it's a part of a long-term process to try and cozy up to all the people he annoyed, talking about same-sex relationships and all that. So I don't take it terribly serious. I think that I'd much rather than the politician talk about God, which is, sort of, as we know, very difficult to do. If they talked about a Christian ethos or talked about faith, the importance of faith to our communities, and did a bit of gospel in their policy, I think that would be a lot more attractive. Because you're on a hiding to nothing as a politician, talking about making proclamations about Christendom.
And I guess he's David Cameron's not coming out and saying, like Margaret maybe is hoping for, you know what, last night I fell down on my knees, good old-fashioned holy rolling, and realised I've been wrong about any number of things. No, it's more seen as, you know, well, let me tell you about my Christian background. Now, who are we to sit in judgment on anyone on that? But of course, Alistair Campbell kind of famously said, look, we just don't do God. And I think he maybe was saying because of the chances of it being misunderstood.
Yeah, I think he in his blog recently said, you know, I wasn't having any problems with Tony Blair being a Christian. And he says in the blog, and he is a Christian, according to his understandings and whatever. So Alistair Campbell wasn't objecting to Tony Blair being a Christian, but just was wary that it would be seen as some kind of cynical ploy in terms of what kind of strategies he was employing. And so for that reason, it was a kind of self-imposed silence. But God loves David Cameron. That is the scandal of the gospel, that God loves conservatives just as much as he loves everybody else.
I should say that other political viewpoints are available, but probably won't get around this table.
Well, I'm just practising what I preach and stating all my own preconceptions so you can judge me on the same basis that I'm judging David Cameron. But, you know, it is true that God does work in mysterious ways and works in everybody's life at different points. And it may well be that there are things that have been happening in the last few months or years with David Cameron that's allowed him to say these things now when he couldn't say them before. So not questioning any of that. I think the basis on which Alistair Campbell was questioning was really that it was, as Steve said, more or less to position himself in relation to his critics within the Conservative Party who would be culturally Christian and quite conservatively Christian.
And do we think, therefore, that he's kind of said, you know, mission accomplished, job done? You know, has this done the job in terms of generating the right headlines of people saying how terrible that you should talk about this and others saying, no, let's have more of the same?
Well, it's done a quite interesting. It's allowed the Deputy Prime Minister to argue for the disestablishment of the Church of England.
It has indeed, yeah.
As someone who has proclaimed his atheism, you know, I mean, this is back to this point about if you say where you come from, this is good. Nick Clegg has been a very overtly atheist person with a very high moral code, just no matter what you think about, you know, Liberal Democrat politics. And so he was able to say, my moral code doesn't need a faith to derive itself from. And I think the best thing that the Church of England could do is disestablish. Now, we have to ask Steve, as a priest within the Anglican Communion, what he feels about that.
So I was thinking about David Cameron there. So you caught me off guard.
It's all right. Disestablishment?
Disestablishment, absolutely. there's nothing worse than domesticated Christianity. The less established the church, the better. But what I was going to say was, wouldn't it be good if David Cameron, instead of saying, as he did, a really sort of hopelessly weak thing to say, I don't know much about theology, as a sort of, you know, introduction to his remarks, be to sort of gather some theologians around himself, some ethicists, and tackle an informed Christian perspective on his policies. I think that would be good to talk about.
Let's
I'd much rather
it.
He talked about that.
I'd be interested to know what does a Christian country look like? What are the characteristics that would make a country Christian? Because if we don't know that, then we can't sort of say what we're like.
Or indeed, can there be such a thing?
Well, that's,
you know,
never been one, I suspect.
Well, we had a good go after the Reformation, and it was generally considered to be not a happy place to be.
That's why we need independence.
Listen, I've got the final word for you on this.
Okay.
Can I recommend that you pick up a copy of the current Private Eye, who have an article entitled "God Says I Don't Do Cameron." A short quote: God today surprised religious observers by distancing himself from David Cameron, saying, "It's true that I sort of believe in him, but my faith comes and goes, and to be honest, I have my doubts."
Okay. Well, I'm not sure that we've quite agreed whether or not politicians should do God, though. We're maybe saying that they should do theology. I think that's a really good one. Yeah. I think I like that, Steve. So thank you for that. And yeah, we caught your little advert there as well, your little viewpoint. That's why we need independence. That'll be a later moral mixdown, rest assured. We will at some point
come back in August.
Get the claymores out and get the ward ready for our face. Okay. Okay, folks, there you go. That's Small Voice for the month of May, done and dusted. Our thanks to Steve Butler for kicking around, and our thanks to you, faithful listener, for getting this far as well. We're off to practice our acceptance speech for the Sanford St Martin Awards in June. Did I mention we'd been nominated? You never know, we might even live tweet from the ceremony. Personally, I'm going to see if I can photobomb a bishop, and if that sounds childish, well, what's the point in being grown up if you can't act childish?